Well, welcome everyone. We're delighted that you're here and we get to spend the next hour with you. My name is Wayne Schmidt.
And I'm Paul Anthus.
And I want to lay a little bit of a foundation, about 3 minutes, because we're going to launch into talking about a relationship that God has used powerfully in each of our lives. As you know, in the Wesleyan Church, we are about made new, transforming lives, churches, and communities through the hope and holiness of Jesus Christ. And as we as a church thought about, okay, if that's happening, what would we see? And what would we celebrate? And so that led to this statement. We celebrate every time a disciple makes a disciple, every time a church multiplies itself, because it is local churches that plant churches, until the Wesleyan Church has a transforming presence in every community, zip code, or as they say in Canada, Tim Hortons. It's near every population center. And so we recognize God has blessed us to be an incrementally growing denomination, but we also realize our mission field, North America, and the 90-some countries we serve, is growing and changing faster, and we're not keeping up. And there's a gospel gap that's forming because of it. More and more people who do not have an opportunity to make informed decision about Jesus Christ. And so we're praying for a movement. And we go back to the original description, shorthand, of the Apostle Paul, not Paul the Anthus, but Paul the Apostle. And it says this, of that original movement, and Christ himself. Let me just stop there. What a reminder that if it's going to be a movement of God, it won't be humanly generated. It's going to be the Spirit that makes it happen. And he gave some to be apostles, prophets, evangelists, shepherds, teachers. So it's going to take different kinds of roles in people, but all of them being fully engaged. But they all have the same task, to prepare God's people. They're all equippers for works of service, and the body of Christ will be built up. So every believer is a minister. And that's foundational. And so what we're praying for these days is a kingdom force. We like to think of this group of people prepared to serve as a kingdom force. And this kingdom force must be multi-generational, multi-ethnic, multi-economic. It must include women and men fully expressing their gifts. And it must include laity and clergy. There's never been a significant movement of God without significant involvement of laity. So, it's with that background that we want to talk about a relationship that God has entrusted to us. And the first way we think about it, or the way it started, was as an accountability partnership.
So Wayne and I go back 34 years in our accountability relationship. It was 1985, and we ventured into a relationship of asking each other if we'd like to hold each other accountable. I had had two previous experiences with that. One was at the end of a class, and they asked us to meet with someone for either 3 or 6 months just to have some basic accountability about the application of that class. So I had a little experience with that. And then I tried an accountability relationship with a good friend of mine. We got off to a good start, but after some time passed, the accountability started to go away. When we met, we talked about our hobbies, sports, areas of interest, things like that, and the accountability kept getting smaller and smaller. It really wasn't an accountability relationship anymore. So we ended that relationship. We're still good friends to this day. There was no harm. But after that, Wayne and I had a conversation about, gee, would you like to try an accountability relationship? Not sure we knew what we were getting into, but that's how it started 34 years ago in that process. So,
and I had a felt need that really prepared me for this relationship, and that is I have an Achilles heel of insecurity. And early in my ministry, that drove me to try to please everyone and to try to prove myself in ministry. And this need to please and need to prove caused me to overcommit to work. And I was neglecting my own self-care. I was neglecting Jan, my wife. And I was experiencing the very tangible impact of workaholism. My genuine call to ministry had become combined with the drives that were rooted in the deficits of my life. And so I knew I needed a change, and I read a book by Gordon MacDonald called Ordering Your Private World and the difference between being called and being driven. And I thought, if I'm going to change, I'll never do it alone. I need someone who will reinforce what I want in my heart so it becomes the way I live my life. And there was this person in our church that I thought, maybe he's the one who can help me in that regard.
It's been a heavy load to carry all these 34 years.
You should have seen me when we started. I was a wreck. Oh, my.
At that stage in my life, I was only a Christian for about 6 years, I think. I didn't grow up in a Christian home. I accepted Christ after I graduated from college. But I, too, wanted to grow. I wanted more out of my faith, and that was part of the interest of having an accountability relationship. I'm a certified financial planner. I own a wealth management firm, so we work with people's comprehensive planning and investments. And there's a lot of things that are not healthy in that world as far as your faith is concerned. So I wanted someone to journey with that could help me through that process, keep my faith intact, and still be a successful business person in the marketplace. And so we started at that time, not sure all that we were getting into. Just give you an idea of how it worked and still does. We would meet once every 2 weeks. We've missed very few times in 34 years that we've met every 2 weeks to discuss our accountability. Our basic design was Wayne would come to my office. We'd go to a conference room. We each of us had prepared at that point a list of goals or commitments that we had committed to, and we were going to report on those during our time together. And our desire and our suggestion for you is those commitments should be something you can answer yes or no to. So being a better father is a worthy thing for me to pursue, but how am I going to assess if I've been a better father over the last 2 weeks? Like, well, yeah, I've been a pretty good dad, so yeah, I'll say yes to that. Now, we're looking for something specific I can do, so maybe it's dating my children. They're older now. Maybe it's sending them a text or an email or a letter or something like that. So we would pick something specific that would make me a better father, and I would answer yes, I did that, or no, I didn't do that in the last 2 weeks. So we would take turns going first, still do. We go through our list of commitments, answer yes or no to those things, whether we did them or not. And then at the end of that, we get to process life together. What are some of the high points, low points? What are the challenges I'm facing? Gee, I need your input on this. What do you think? So after those list of items, we would go through that life council, so to speak, and share life with one another. And then we went out to lunch after that. And we ordered it that way on purpose because if we started with lunch, who knows if the accountability would happen. Maybe it'd get squeezed out. By putting it first, it always happened. And if something got shortchanged, it was our lunch, not our accountability. So that's worked really well for us in this rhythm over these 34 years. So.
And one of the things we recognize is there's a tendency to say, okay, accountability, I'm going to pick 5 or 10 things I'm not doing well and have someone hold me accountable for. That's not what we were going for. We had a very small list in the beginning, and I thought of it in terms of raising my batting average. So am I having devotions once in a while? Yes. Is it as consistent as I want it to be? Could someone encouraging me raise my batting average? So it wasn't Paul coming to me and say, Wayne, here's a list of things I know you got to work on, buddy. And it wasn't things like 5 things I wasn't doing at all. I wanted to start doing all at once. That sets you up for failure. It's things you're already doing and you say, I just want to do them more consistently. And I know if I answer yes or no to someone who's an encourager to me, it's more likely that it's going to happen.
In fact, our advice to you is if you try this, is that you would set a specified period of time to have a trial relationship with someone. 3 months, 6 months, something like that. You could go to someone and say, I just want to experiment with accountability. Would you like to do that with me? But we're going to go for 6 months, and at the end, both of us are released. We can both walk away. Nothing has to continue. You just want to try it. Your goals should be a few, maybe three. And one of those should probably be one that you could easily meet, but it's worth inspecting. It's worth something looking at. Don't try to stretch it too far. Otherwise, you have this negative spiral that you experience and the lack of momentum. If you start the other way and you have some early success, you lean into doing more, I think, and use positive momentum to move that forward. And then what we're talking about here is, well, we have accountability in lots of areas of our lives. If I speed on the highway, I might get a ticket. If I don't file my taxes right, I can get in trouble. If I don't show up for work, if I'm in school and don't do my class, there's areas of accountability all around our lives that we've grown up with and live with. But what we're talking about here is voluntary accountability. And that's the most powerful type. It's for me to say, yes, I'm volunteering. I'd like you to hold me accountable. I want to accomplish more. Will you help me do that? And that is extremely powerful when you use that as a tool to try and grow and mature in your life. And then we need to develop the skill, you probably don't have much of this yet, to be held accountable in a healthy way and to hold someone accountable in a healthy way. This is not beating another person up. It's not pointing your finger at them. It's not criticizing them. You're there to help them. You want to help them grow and mature in their spiritual journey. So holding someone accountable that's voluntary is very easy to do. We do it simply with questions. Gee, Wayne, when you set that goal, it was important to you. Is it still important to you now? Can you feel the dig? I'm not doing it. All I'm asking him is it still important or not? Gee, Wayne, you haven't done that in the last two or three times we met. Is there something you need to change? Is there something I can help you with so you can be successful in that area? I'm not criticizing him at all. I'm simply asking questions about what he wanted to accomplish. So holding someone accountable that way is actually a very easy thing to do, but you do need some skill and ability to do that, and also to receive the accountability from someone. This isn't about making excuses. This isn't about talking your way out of something. It's about being honest of whether I did it or not. And all of us have this ability, I think, to deceive ourselves and come up with a perfectly good explanation why I didn't do something I should have or something I did wrong, and left just to our own thoughts, we're perfectly fine. This makes perfect sense to me. I'm in the right here. And this has happened to me. I've done that. I've shown up for Wayne, and I'm trying to explain it to him. And as the words are coming out of my mouth, my brain's going, this makes no sense at all. It made perfect sense when I was shaving this morning, but it's making no sense at all now. Just exposing that out there does some amazing things that battles what Satan wants to do in our lives.
So we know that people seek other kinds of accountability. For instance, they may have a coach for something, that type of thing. That's fine. Our accountability is peer accountability. It's not that we're like each other in every way, because there are significant differences, but it's something that we come into essentially as peers. And sometimes accountability is focused on one area. But for us, our accountability is a holistic accountability. So we will have a goal or two related to our own personal life with Jesus. Maybe it relates to our quiet times or to those types of things. We'll have a goal or two related to our marriage, a goal or two related to our children or grandchildren in my case. We'll have these areas so that overall, there's kind of a holistic approach to it. Early on, I think we called it our top 10 list, and we might have had one or two goals from each area. We didn't start there, but that kind of developed maybe in the first few years of our relationship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and one of the things I was looking for that I could understand at that time, I didn't understand the full depth of what our relationship would become, but I've played a lot of sports in my life, worked out, those types of things. You work out at a different level when you work out alone and when you work out with a workout partner. Can you understand that? that, hey, if it's just me going to the gym,
I don't get it really.
If I'm going to the gym just by myself, I can skip that. There's no one else involved. But if I'm meeting my accountability partner there or my workout partner there, that's a different thing. I don't want to stand them up. Even when you're working out, you'll do more by journeying with someone else. That's what I wanted from our accountability relationship that I already understood from athletics, but I thought it could happen in my spiritual life and journey as well, and it did.
So we were maybe in different places in terms of our background and things, but one thing we had in common was similar desire for this. What really doesn't work very well is if one person wants it and the other person really doesn't, because it'll end up at the lowest level. It's not unlike a marriage where if one partner's really committed and the other's not really committed, it tends to drag the marriage down. So I looked for someone who really wanted to accomplish certain things in their life and wanted the encouragement and support, and at the same time that I knew I would feel like, I don't want to disappoint this person. I want to be able to say yes to them when we meet.
Yeah, you're looking for lack of a better word, a certain chemistry, and part of that is the level of interest and intensity that you're looking for. So if that's mismatched, you're probably not going to have a long-lasting relationship. So Wayne and I brought a similar level of intensity and interest into this. Just one example, that we schedule these meetings every 2 weeks. We hardly ever move those meeting dates. Both of us assign it as a very high priority in our lives. We commit to it. We're going to show up. We're going to be ready. If I was matched with someone who wanted to change the date every once in a while and sometimes wasn't prepared, that would not be a long-lasting relationship for me. I would lose interest in that very quickly. So you're looking for someone who has that similar level of interest and intensity to find the right chemistry in the relationship to make it successful.
So I got to tell you, it feels a little weird at first when you come and you've got your list, and we take turns. So one time Paul starts first, the next time I start first. And you sit down, you maybe say, have you had a pretty decent couple of weeks? Yeah, how about you? Sure. Okay, who goes first? I mean, that's how it kind of starts, goes the list. You already mentioned we do accountability first, and if we want to hang out more, and we most times did afterwards, we made some time for that, for just catching up on each other's lives. But the purpose of the relationship is accountability. So if someone would say, are you and Paul best friends? I would probably say, Paul and I are soul friends. In other words, we don't hang out a lot together. I mean, the guy's into athletics, so he's always playing pickleball and tennis. If I played those sports with him, it would frustrate him to death. He would have to lower the levels so much, he would say, why am I doing this? So, and I don't go out to eat with him because the guy's a boring eater. I mean, he eats grilled chicken no matter what restaurant we go to. So he tried to get me to take up golf. That didn't work out so well either. And I said, if I'm going to pay this much money and spend this much time, I'm going to do something I want to do. And so, you know, there are things we don't like hang out together all the time. But it's almost like a Matthew 6:33 relationship. The primary purpose of this relationship is not so that Paul and Wayne can become best buds, but it's so that he can seek the kingdom of God first and I can seek the kingdom of God first. And I have a person who's going to go there with me in that.
Yeah, so there's things that people approach me about and say, did you know this about Wayne? I'm going, no, I didn't. Did you know this? And they're thinking, gosh, why don't you know those things? A lot of those things tend to be more superficial and just outward things. I do know Wayne's biggest weaknesses. I know where he struggles. I know his strengths. I know his greatest victories. I know those in a lot of detail. I don't know some of the superficial stuff. And likewise, Wayne knows those things about me as well.
So it's a place, you know, where you can do the one another's. Confess your sins to one another. Pray for one another. You know, go. Where do you get some of those one another's? And it's that kind of a one another relationship for us. Now, we've been at it 34 years, as we said. And so in the beginning, and maybe this is a bit of a stereotype, but maybe this is the way guys tend to start, we didn't know each other well. So didn't we walk in and say, hey, Paul, let's start by me sharing my deepest, darkest secret with you? or my greatest struggle. It was more, these are a few areas that I'm getting done pretty well, but I'd really like to do better. Would you be able to ask me about them every other week just to help me raise my batting average type of thing?
So in our opinion, you would start slow, and trust and confidentiality needs to be demonstrated and earned. And so I wasn't going to share deep, dark secrets with Wayne until I knew he would be confidential with it, until I knew he could be trusted with that. So I would open those windows very slowly. That needs to be earned, but you want to get there eventually because of the depth of that and the benefits that provides. It's very strong.
So what kind of happened then that we didn't really start out as an intent was our relationship evolved in another way. And if we characterize this as accountability partnership, what began to develop was a kingdom partnership. And the best way I know to characterize this is that that this is a partnership where it not only exists for God, but it begins that we can make a bigger difference for the kingdom together. We called an Ezra-Nehemiah relationship. And you remember Ezra was the priest. He was like the ordained person. I'm a clergy. And Nehemiah was not ordained, a very high-capacity lay person. But the walls of the city needed to be rebuilt in order for there to be security and place in worship. And so, and it says at the end of this passage, which talks about it, it says, the joy of their Lord, the joy of the Lord is their strength. Paul and I, over time, have developed a relationship where the strengths and capacities he brings as a layperson in the marketplace, which is his ministry place, and maybe some of the strengths that I bring as an ordained minister and my primary place is usually within the church or churches, maybe there's a joy of the Lord that's our strength that develops when we enter into partnership with one another. And we've come to think of this as a Ezra-Nehemiah relationship or a kingdom partnership. Now, a little bit of biblical history here. Did you know that early on, Ezra and Nehemiah were one book? And then at the time of Origen, about the 3rd century, they were separated. I think that's a picture of what's happened. And quite frankly, I think it's a strategy of the enemy. It's almost like what a clergy person doesn't belong together with what a lay person does. And I think the enemy knows the power of laity and clergy fully expressing their gifts. And he's going to do anything he can do to separate the books so that it doesn't happen. So we're trying to learn all the time about what are the things we might do together that would result in so much more if we were simply trying to do them ourselves. Paul's talked about it in this way.
So when a pastor and a lay person, a marketplace leader, get together, it often starts with a level of suspicion. Why might this person want to have a relationship with me? What are they up to? I'm thinking, what does the pastor want from me? The pastor's thinking, what does this person want from me? And so it almost always starts with a level of suspicion and suspect about why this relationship might even be formed or why we're even getting together. Then it might move to a transaction that's more specific. Well, what's in it for me? Kind of a self-centered. If I'm friends with him or help him in the church, what's in it for me? He might be thinking the same way, looking toward a marketplace person. So part of it's a transaction-based thing. But if you can get beyond that, it can be transformational and be part of our ministry and our mission. So if you can make it through those phases, which Wayne and I did, and the walls are broken down, we're not suspicious of each other anymore, we're trusting each other, some amazing things can happen then that I think are a powerful force for advancing the kingdom that wouldn't exist otherwise unless laity and pastors are united together.
And you'll notice if you can work through that suspicion, there's transformation. I mean, it makes a difference in your personal life, but there's also things you can accomplish in mission together that you wouldn't have. There are some things Ezra could do that Nehemiah couldn't, but there's some things Nehemiah could do Ezra couldn't. Put them together, so there's the mission is more accomplished. There's a link here, and by the way, at the end of the presentation, I'm going to give you my email, and if you want all the slides, you'll have them. So don't feel like, oh man, I got to write down this link or whatever. But this was a link where 10 reasons business people tend not to fully engage with their church or their pastors. And it certainly was a get-you-thinking type of
yep.
thing.
I just want to share a couple of those with you out of the 10 that I think are pretty common. One is, I mentioned, is not being appreciated as a fellow minister in the kingdom of God. So clergy don't always see us that way. In our relationship, I consider myself to be a minister. I am not ordained. I do not have a church, but I nonetheless consider myself to be a minister of the gospel. I consider myself to be in full-time Christian service, even though I work for a for-profit company. All I had to do was change the way I thought about that to try and battle that. Another one is business leaders are only viewed as a cash cow for the church. And so sometimes business people are looked at, we really don't want you involved, we just let you write a check. And I've had that experience with charities in my community and things like that. They pretend to be interested, but really what they want is a check that's written, and that harms the relationship. Here's one, pastors do not know how to utilize great marketplace leaders. So I realize that. Pastors are running their local church, and then they've got this powerful marketplace leader. They don't know how to plug them in. They don't know how to get them in the right spot in their congregation sometimes. So oftentimes they put them in a wrong role, which is only going to frustrate them over time. And another one I'd mention is not crafting a proper discipleship plan. So how can the pastor help this marketplace person grow in their faith, their maturity? How can they craft a plan that works for them? So those are just some that out of those 10 that we wanted to mention with you.
So here's some benefits that we see have come out of this kingdom partnership that's developed.
Yeah, this was fun. This was not what we anticipated when we started the accountability relationship. But as the Ezra-Nehemiah part of it developed, these started to show up, and they were great fun. Each can get access not available to the other. So I run in circles and realms that Wayne as a pastor will never get to. He'll never have that conversation. And he runs in circles and realms that I'll never get to that have that conversation. And we get to share stories about this, that if he's with a group of business people and they don't know he's a pastor, he can carry himself really well with a business conversation. But then if they ask the question, what do you do for a living, what happens? Oh, a pastor. Suddenly the conversation changed. You know, their guard goes up, their language improves, things like that. It does. For me, the same way is true. If I'm working in areas of spiritual influence, college boards, things like that, I can go so far, but when they find out what I do for an occupation, it changes the conversation a little bit. They see me differently. So it's been really fun to have access to each other's world, and to share that experience has made us better at it. Insights received from our partnership. Separate callings, but we're both better Christians because of the perspective that we bring. So to have Wayne's insights into my business and what I do for a living have been very valuable, and I think I've been able to contribute to views in the church. I can give him the view of what it's like to hear that sermon as a business person sitting in the pew. I say, Wayne, I don't think you intended to communicate this, but this is what it sounded like to a marketplace leader. Increased comfort and familiarity with each other's realms. I've gotten very comfortable. I know a fair amount what it's like to be a senior pastor of a church. I know the island that it is, the isolation that it is, the problems that go with that. He knows a lot about my world and the temptations I face in a world of business and greed and things like that. So that's been helpful as well. Here's a really strong one for me was the affirmation of a vocational ministry. So what I said to you is I believe I'm a minister. I believe I'm in full-time Christian service. And my pastor supported me in that endeavor. I felt sent from my local church. So it wasn't service apart from my church. It was in addition to serving at my church, I also served in the marketplace. So I didn't feel guilty about doing things in the marketplace that had nothing to do with our home church. And he supported me in that. So from a marketplace standpoint, that is extremely powerful that I felt sent almost like a missionary to our local city to try and be a force for God's kingdom in the business realms that I was in. Extremely powerful benefit that we can pursue. And then we can lend credibility to each other. So there's some settings where knowing that Wayne is a pastor, now the general superintendent, he's my accountability partner. There's some credibility I get in some settings with that, and I think vice versa for you. So those are some of the things that we stumbled across that we really found beneficial in our relationship.
So a very practical example of lending credibility. If I say to a business person, you know, I have some understanding of business people and the challenges they face. They say, yeah, right. If Paul says to a business person, you know, Wayne understands business people and some of the challenges they face. Boom, completely different. So his credibility gives me a head start, if you will, in forming some of these relationships.
Then we've been able to do some fun activities together. Stewardship development, donor discipleship strategy. Just to know what it's like from both our perspectives to deal with stewardship's been fun. One of the things that we did later on the list is a spiritual gift of giving class. And so how many of your congregants would show up with the name of a class being the spiritual gift of giving? And they might be a little hesitant about that, thinking it's fundraising. So we had a great time with that class. Myself, another gentleman, and Wayne formed that. We needed Wayne to invite people to the class because we couldn't get them to attend otherwise. It was his credibility and his ask that got them in the room. Once we got him in the room, Wayne exited the room. We didn't ask for any money, and we studied the spiritual gift of giving. And it was a blast. And it just blossomed into some amazing things.
So Romans 12:8, for instance, yep, talks about the spiritual gift of giving. And we equip people for other spiritual gifts, but we don't equip them for that gift. So we defined it this way. It's the gift, the ability to make and manage money in such a way that creates a surplus, a portion of which is then given to the kingdom of God. So session one was making money for God. Where in church do you hear it talked about, for your ministry, we'd like you to make more money next year?
You could feel the discomfort in the room. We're like, okay, we're in church and we're talking about making money. Something's not right here. People are just kind of real nervous about that.
And they did wait for the shoe to drop. Okay, when's the ask going to come? Or when's Wayne going to enter back into the room and the pastor? You know, that type of thing. But it was a place for lay people of high capacity to have a very honest conversation, knowing that the expected outcome was not, okay, here's what we're going to ask you for. And, boy, that class...
Blossom. We started, there were a lot of people in the room that were sitting in their chair with their arms folded and their heels dug in because they weren't sure what to expect. They're pretty sure it was fundraising. By the end of the class, we had people that wanted to continue. We formed a couple small groups out of that that went on for years where people could safely talk about what is it like to donate money? What is it like to be asked for money? How do we navigate all this together? That could have not that would have not happened if Wayne and I hadn't been in partnership together. I don't think we could have pulled it off.
So you can tell from that there's some areas of where we team together very specifically, like an event that was hosted for business people that we were in together. But there were other settings where I said, boy, Paul, I'm not just going to be able to get very far with this, but would you be there? And I could trust him completely to be in those conversations or settings, and it was better that I was not there. We kind of call that strategic presence. Or strategic absence, mm-hmm, which is better in terms of getting the goal accomplished. But most of the things we've had an opportunity to do, something 59 minutes.
So we tried to reach out to business and professional people in our congregation to focus on their specific needs. So one of the things we formed was a lunch called 59 minutes. It's called that because we were going to get them out in 59 minutes. We were going to be on time. We put speakers in front of them that would talk about the integration of faith and business. It was things they could use in their work, and Wayne and I co-hosted that. One of those we hosted at a private club in our downtown area so we could invite people into that. We might get 15 to 25 people. And Wayne and I would teach it together. It was very much spiritual and marketplace all combined together that the two of us could pull off because the two of us were doing that. Conversations with people of wealth. So I, as a job, in my job, I deal with people who have a lot of wealth, many of them Christians and things like that. My conversations with them and my ability to deal with them are better and enhanced because of my relationship with Wayne. And I think it's also true in your direction as well, knowing what it's like to work with people in those situations.
Yeah, I did not grow up around people of wealth, etc. So it was hard for me to really have an understanding or appreciation. Quite frankly, because of that, I would tend to be intimidated or tend to think that people with wealth don't have issues or challenges that they're working through. And as I hung out with Paul, I really began to have an understanding and maybe an increased capacity to connect with people that have a lot of resources but also face some common challenges.
So in that area specifically, each of us were able to go farther and have a greater impact because of our relationship than we could have done alone, for sure. And then one as simple as dedication of another's workspace. So when we moved into our last space, I invited Wayne in and we did a litany of dedication for our office space, just asking God to use it as part of His kingdom work. Invited the employees. It wasn't mandatory. It was a wonderful way just to dedicate that space as a place of marketplace ministry for God's kingdom work. So
I think it's really significant, pastors, that we recognize so much of the work that's going to be done in disciple making in the kingdom of God is not going to happen in the walls of the church. We need marketplace missionaries. We need people who understand that their calling is the same as our calling, just the context in which we work that out is different. And what if the best thing they can do for the kingdom is not, you know, diaper changes in the nursery or greeting and ushering and so on? What if the best thing they can do for the kingdom is to say, yeah, we're going to need you to help us with some things at church every once in a while, but you are a marketplace minister, and we bless that. And how can we support you in that? And how can you help us connect with that marketplace as a result of the credibility relationship?
Yeah, so if I can speak to the pastors for a moment, your ability to send marketplace people out as missionaries, if you will, into your local market is extremely strong. I did not feel guilty about it. I didn't feel like I was neglecting the church. I was involved in the church. But I had Wayne's full support. I could share success stories with him. I could share kingdom success stories. It had nothing to do with our local church with him, and he would affirm me for it. We would celebrate it together. In some settings, that's not true. If it wasn't for the local church, I wouldn't share it with the local pastor. I'm kind of out there alone on that. So your ability to send those people and convince them that they are ministers in the marketplace is extremely powerful.
So one of the ways Paul reminds me of that is he's formed what's called his non-vocational ministry advisory team. Isn't that a handle? Isn't that a long name? I've been trying to get him to change it, to come up with something, you know, sexier or something, you know, to kind of describe it. But there's a reason he insists on that. That advisory team, which consists of me as his accountability partner, Cindy as his wife, and the COO of his company, that advisory team meets with him to consider ministry opportunities that come up to him outside of the context of his company. So this is to serve on school board or university boards or other community engagement boards, to be involved in certain other ministry activities, etc. But the reason he insists on non-vocational ministry activity, it's a reminder that what he does for a vocation as a financial planner is a ministry. It's all kinds of spiritual opportunities when you talk to people about their money. So it's not like Paul does that secular job which deals with money. That's a necessary evil. And then he does ministry when he does this stuff at church. He's doing ministry every day in his marketplace context. And then beyond that, he gets some non-vocational or not associated with his company, his work, ministry opportunities.
And that took me a while to get there, and without Wayne's help, I'm not sure I would have arrived there. I didn't start there early in my Christian journey. Life was very much in compartments. I was a young Christian. I honestly thought I had to get my work done at the office so I could go to work and be part of God's kingdom work. I saw it as that separate. God has broken down all those barriers now, but that took decades to do that. And I do want to say that one of my attractions to accountability now, if Wayne were not available, I would still want to be in an accountability relationship because of the value of an inspected life. To have someone else looking in and inspecting your life is an extremely powerful force. When you say to someone, this is important to me, I'm going to do it, and I'm giving you permission to ask me in 2 weeks if you did it or not, it's an extremely powerful force. There's something in almost every one of us that says, I do not want to answer no to that question. I really want to get it done. And so I carried that not only from our accountability relationship, but into a greater area of my life. Some business people think I'm crazy that I put in the same room my accountability partner 34 years, my chief operating officer that knows everything about what I do in the business, and my wife that knows all of my personal life, and I give them free rein over me and say, if I'm doing something wrong, if I'm off base, if I have any blind spots, I would like to hear it from you. I'd rather have the wounds of a friend than the fallout of screwing up my life. And so I value that inspected life so much that I'm willing to do that. And the benefits, even though most people would view that as something scary, the benefits so far outweigh the negatives that it's well worth it. So
we have time for some questions. Do you have a last word you want before we dive into those?
I would like to say that your experience shouldn't be just like Wayne and I. We're just giving you an example. We hope that you could have an experience like ours that fits your unique situation, your unique personality. We want you to try that. What I want to share with you is the benefit of having someone in your life that's going to journey with you. To journey alone, we can only go so far. And Satan, I think, uses isolation as a really strong tool in our lives to keep us down, to keep us defeated. Satan knows each one of our weaknesses and how to poke at us and how to keep us held down for kingdom work. So to have someone in your life that knows you really well, loves you enough to tell you the truth, and is willing to journey with you is an extremely powerful force. I like to view it as back-to-back, that if Wayne and I were in trouble and we were fighting an enemy, he's got my back and I've got his back. And this is how I kind of view our relationship. I can share anything. I share my sin with him. I share my weaknesses, my failures. I also get to share with him victories and things I could not share in any other settings. It just wouldn't be appropriate. It would be bragging or things like that. But with Wayne, I can share those things. So I don't want you to journey alone, and an accountability relationship might be one way that you could do that, to go further and farther than you could ever go alone.
So we have our first question. All right.
You were in the same locale at one point.
Yes.
Before Wayne
deserted me, you mean? And
left town? He's got abandonment issues.
Yeah. Very good question. So Wayne was the local pastor in my church. I live in Grand Rapids, Michigan for 30 years. Most of that was our accountability relationship. Then he deserted me and went to Indiana Wesleyan University to start the seminary. And I had serious doubts about whether our relationship could keep the same intensity and level of benefit over that distance. And so he has grandchildren in our area, so he makes it back. I get a few meetings per year with them, but most of it's been by Zoom or Skype now. And I was pleasantly surprised how effective that has been. Part of that might be because we had a really strong relationship first. About 5 minutes into that conversation over the technology, I forget the technology's there. I'm seeing Wayne. I'm hearing him. I get right into it. So it can be done over distance. I think there's some challenges to it, but I still think you'd want some time in person periodically to have that connection.
And because he's not intersecting with my world more, I've had to do some additional things. Like a very tangible thing is my executive assistant that I work with, Gloria Lopez, she has Paul's contact information. And if there is anything I ever do that concerns her, she can confidentially call him. And so when Paul came to our office, introduced himself so that he is known to her, He has access to my calendar. So because he's not intersecting with the people I work with as naturally as he did before, I've had to try to add some things that would give him insight into what's going on with my world beyond what he could see firsthand. But I think the fact it started in person and then went to technology really works. So I would say if someone's going to have a primary Zoom relationship, I'm probably entering into that right now with someone I'm going to disciple. It's going to be important early on, at least we spend some time personally, because technology feels very different once you know the person than if it's the only way you know the person. So,
Justin?
She's in the room. Be careful.
Your spouses have access to the other person. So you said your assistant can call Paul. If Cindy or Jan notices something, are they a part of the equation? Can Jan call Paul?
No way. She does not have his contact information.
Yeah. No, yes, they do, Justin. They do have access to that. We would actually encourage it if there's something there. A couple things I'd mention about the spouse. There are topics. Cindy and I have a dispute, and she's wrong, I'm sure, and I'm right. But I might have to ask her permission in order to share that with Wayne. Even though I know he's confidential, I can trust him, it might be a topic that's sensitive enough that maybe I should ask her permission first before discussing that.
And I always remember that Cindy and I aren't accountability partners. Paul and I are accountability partners. So I'm not here to hear Cindy's issues, and Paul usually doesn't spend hardly any time there. It's much more, help me with my part. Help me with what I might need to change or do to make this situation different. So I'm his accountability partner. We're not here to collaborate on our spouses.
So real life insight into that. Say Cindy and I do have an argument. Working up to the meeting, I'm pretty sure I'm mostly in the right and Cindy was mostly in the wrong. That happens sometimes. When I get to the meeting, as I start sharing it, the truth comes out and I'm thinking, okay, Cindy did do one thing wrong, but I did five things wrong. And I end up telling Wayne that and going, she did do this, but I did all this. And before the next meeting, I need to take these corrective steps to do that. It's pretty amazing that the ability for me to apologize to my wife and ask for her forgiveness goes way up after I meet with Wayne, to be honest with you. Powerful force.
What are some of the ways that you erode tension in that, the suspicion, excuse me, of the lady with the business leader and things like that? How would you find the best ways that you guys have seen that happen?
Yeah, time together. So in most of those conversations, asking more questions rather than making more statements is probably a good idea. Wayne has said before that when a pastor gets nervous, they probably talk more rather than less. And so maybe a key is that when you get nervous, ask more questions rather than make more statements. But it's over time, you've got to feel each other out. You've got this kind of give and take. Entering into each other's worlds, having real conversations. I would seek to just deepen the conversation a little bit each time I met with the person and go a little bit deeper and see what happens.
And Kenneth, I know you have a significant relationship with someone like this, and pastors, can I encourage you, if you have that kind of relationship, talk about it with people.
Yeah.
And talk about it with other pastors. These kind of relationships should be viewed as normative for the kingdom, not
yes.
an anomaly for the kingdom.
Yes.
And so we got to help each other with this, pastors. If I can learn something from you about significant and deep spiritual relationship with someone who has a marketplace impact, I need to learn that. And likewise, you may need to learn from some others as well about that particular relationship. Paul mentioned something in passing. I just want to allude to that. I do think pastors generally, if we're nervous or a little bit intimidated, sometimes get talkative and sometimes get preachy. We kind of filibuster. So, I'm not sure what they'll say or how to handle it, so I'll just keep talking. I have found that just having a question or two, listening, taking notes, following up and thanking them, and here's one thing I've put into action as a result of what you shared with me. And would you be willing to meet again sometime? And again, come with a question or two. And I have found that builds a bond. And there's one of my mentors taught me recently, the higher capacity of the leader, the more their leadership is developed by you listening to them than speaking to them. And so if I can just have one or two questions, that may be all it takes to begin to build a relationship. I don't have to totally understand their world and play like I do verbally. I can just ask and learn and maybe feedback. Other questions?
People almost always feel honored when they're asked questions, so you can honor another person by sincerely asking questions and letting them know you were follow up on.
Yeah.
I'd like to hear your recommendation on, as a pastor, and you take the pastor-marketplace relationship, do you think it's unhealthy for another pastor to be your accountability partner or marketplace? I mean, there's not enough pastors for marketplace people to always get it.
Right.
So just in your recommendations as you're reading this, how are you, for an example, we have Celebrate Recovery in our church. We teach accountability partners a lot, if anybody is familiar with that ministry. But I think your accountability, we're talking about, is a lot deeper. I have an accountability partner, but they're in Florida and I'm in Indiana. We don't do Skype. We talk on the phone probably three times a year. But I don't have the closeness that you all have because we haven't ever been in the same zip code. It started as a remote partnership. I'd like to hear just a little bit about, if that makes sense.
Yep. How about clergy to clergy, Wayne? Why would you?
Yeah. By the way, extra credit for using zip code. Since we're out to reach every zip code. Thank you. I do know of several effective clergy to clergy accountability relationships. My only two disclaimers are, one is I don't want pastors to think that's their only option. I'm a pastor. No one gets me. Unless it's another pastor. And sometimes that no one gets me part is no one will help me feel okay about everything, justify. Yeah. So I want pastors to stop and think, is there a lay person who would be the best accountability person for me? The second thing I've found is when you have similarities, like we're very similar in intensity and our desire to grow spiritually, etc., but our worlds are very different. There's almost a richness to the relationship when you don't have the same kind of life and do the same kind of work and all, because then you end up talking shop a lot of times. So I do think there are some advantages to having a lay clergy accountability relationship. I would say, especially if there's a lay person you think you could trust close to you, it would do wonders for your account to have someone you could meet with more frequently and maybe more personally.
Yeah, good thoughts. Yes?
So, if I can add to that, how did you overcome that fear, the age-old fear of you don't disclose to the laity of your church and let them see where you dark secrets in the past?
Yeah. Number one, I think that is an outdated, if it was ever right, it's not right now. People appreciate transparency. Now, they don't appreciate it in real time. They often like you to be transparent about the struggles you had 6 months ago and have now resolved. They don't want you to get up on Sunday and say, right now, I'm a mess. So transparency in real time still makes them nervous. But there is an appreciation for vulnerability to openness. So I do think that that part of it has changed. I have an advantage here, and Paul mentioned confidentiality. He deals with wealthy people. Confidentiality is very important. Wealthy people, a lot of them have very complex situations. You take dysfunction in a family and you add money to it, it just gets more complicated because they can fund their dysfunction. So But he is so confidential. There were people in our church who I didn't know were his clients, and I would only find out as a result of them sharing, because also if they're his clients, because he has a minimum of investable assets, all of a sudden I know something about their financial position. So they're confidentially... confidentiality has to be rock solid. And if it's violated, then that calls the whole thing at risk. And so that's been a big difference maker for that vulnerability.
I think having that layperson who can do that is a hope for outcome, I think. Because once I understood more about Wayne's role, how isolated he was, what it was like to be a pastor, I had his back more often. I could at least sympathize, if not empathize, with what he was going through. I was a safe place for him to go to. I would like every pastor here to have that kind of safe place and go, boy, I think the board really treated me unfairly. I think this happened. I just need to vent that and process it with someone. So it may not happen for all of you, but I wouldn't give up on it. That is a great person to have. And I didn't realize the role I had in that for a while. And then I realized I was actually ministering to our church by being a safe place for Wayne. God opened my eyes to that, going, oh my gosh, if he didn't have this place to go, I don't know what would have happened to him, because it was very hard at times, as you all know. So.
The key, though, is what I think you all said earlier, is just the confidentiality, you have to earn that respect.
Yes.
You don't necessarily dump everything in the first meeting.
Oh, absolutely,
yeah.
Not. I'd be very careful with that, yeah.
So here's our email. If you would like this PowerPoint presentation, just send it to me. Also, what I'm trying to do is create a context in our movement where these partnerships can emerge. So anytime I can hear a story, like I mentioned, Kenneth, I'm aware of a relationship. Anytime I know Ken Nash, these are pastors that I happen to know have these kind of relationships. Let's find those, and maybe at some point our marketplace leaders would connect it a little bit more so they can call out. So perhaps this is part of the movement, is working together in order for this to really emerge. So let me close with a prayer. Father, whatever was not of you, wash it away. Whatever was of you, make it inescapable. May we be not only hearers, but doers. I pray in Jesus' name. Amen. Thank you, everyone. Appreciate you being here.